anti-racism educator Tema Okun writes, "In Judaism, there is a story about the origin of the world, which began, so the story goes, with the Or Ein Sof, meaning light from the holy source. The vessel holding this light broke, shattering into an infinite number of holy sparks as a result of the light of God shining in everyone and everything. Our purpose is to search for and uncover these holy sparks, to free the hidden holiness in everything and everyone. We do this," she says, "through our loving kindness and compassion. Every act of loving kindness, no matter how great or small, repairs the world. And before we can repair the world, we must recognize the world we inhabit." Reverend Dr. Rebecca Parker, one of my teachers, and when I served her as a teaching assistant, she would preach upon a stack of books. She wouldn't have a manuscript. She'd have a stack of books and make her way through them. And so to honor her, I have brought the book that helped shape my sermon to read right from it when it's time. She writes, "In 1976, I began a cross-country road trip on my way to seminary. I traveled with a friend. We had time, so we decided to take back roads. One afternoon, the road passed through rural western Pennsylvania. Late in the day, we came down through hill country into a valley. It had been raining hard, and as we neared a small town, we noticed blinking yellow light, warning of danger. We saw fields covered in standing water and passed several side roads blocked off with the sign saying, 'Road closed.' 'Looks like they've had a flood here,' we said. Coming into town, we crossed a bridge over a wide river. The water was high, muddy, flowing fast. Sandbags lined the roadway. 'Gosh,' we said, 'there must have been quite a lot of high water to contend with here. Looks like a major flood.' We headed out of town following a winding country road, captivated by the evidence all around us that there had been something dramatic. We rounded a bend, and in front of us, a sheet of water covered the roadway. The water was rising fast, like a huge silver balloon being inflated before our eyes. We stopped and started to turn the car around. The water was rising behind us as well. Suddenly, we realized the flood hadn't happened yesterday or last week. It was happening here and now. Dry ground was disappearing fast. We hurriedly clambered out of the car and scrambled to higher ground. Soaked to the bone, we huddled under a fir tree. No longer were we lodged in our familiar vehicle. The cold water of the storm poured down on us, baptizing us into the present, a present from which we had been insulated by both our car and our misjudgments about the country we were traveling through. 'This,' Dr. Parker writes, 'is what it's like to be white in America. It is to travel while ensconced in a secure vehicle, to see signs of what is happening in the world outside the compartment one is traveling in, and not realize the signs have any contemporary meaning. It is to be dislocated, to misjudge your location, and to believe you are uninvolved and unaffected by what is happening in the world.'" James Baldwin wrote, "This is the crime of which I accuse my countrymen, and for which I and history will never forgive them, that they have destroyed and are destroying hundreds and thousands of lives and do not know it and do not wish to know it." Reading Baldwin's The Fire next time helped me recognize my experience. Born white into this country, I was gradually but decisively educated into an alienated state of mind. To come of age in America as a white person is to be educated into ignorance. It is to be culturally shaped to not know and not want to know the context in which you live. Born white in this country, I was gradually and decisively educated into my own alienated state of mind. I've shared with this congregation that my brother was HIV positive and that this was a defining part of my own childhood and adolescence. And even in high school, I was developing this passion for healthcare justice, for becoming a sexuality peer educator. And though I was asked by peers, by those I met in Unitarian Universalist youth groups to engage struggles against racism, I thought I could pick and choose my issues. I would say something like this: No, really, my issue that I care about is health. Racism is not as related to what my cause is. That's not for me. Granted, I was 14, but then, of course, I met activists of color doing work in HIV education and prevention, and this was my baptism into the present moment. And then I was asked to connect the dots, to do the work, to see the intersections of racism and injustice in healthcare. I began to see the scaling of bodies that would happen through exploitation, discrimination, marginalization, and oppression. That oppression kept people sick. To separate the two, this was futile. If I wanted to keep my cause of health centered, I had to face this. I couldn't be insulated by my whiteness or misjudgments about the country through which I was traveling. I could not be an agent of change in health if I didn't see the signs of racism and my own white skin privilege. That is, the rights, the favors, the advantages and immunities that are specially granted to me and other white people, but withheld from another. White privilege is historically based, institutionally perpetuated system of preferential prejudice for white people based solely on skin color or ancestral origin. And it's also an exemption from oppression based on those same things. As my friend, UU activist and radical copy editor, Alex Capitan, says, part of the power of this system is that most individual white people are not conscious of it. Supporting white supremacy doesn't require hatred or even dislike, nor does it require an active or conscious belief that white people are better than everyone else. The system works to keep white people at the center of what's considered default or normal, without most white people even being aware of it. Reverend Karen Quinlan says it like this: culture is simply everything that's around us. At some point in our lives, we learn that there are other ways of being. Our human tendency is to think that ours is somehow better than theirs. When we are white, thinking that ours is better is supported by the fact that our social and political systems are being built through the same frames we were looking. We learn that our way is the right way and the best way. Simply put, this is white supremacy culture. As Unitarian Universalists, when we intentionally learn about white supremacy or privilege, we are asking each other to feel our way through. One of the ways that oppression operates is by cutting us off from our feelings, numbing us to our exploitation, or to the cost of benefiting at the expense of other people. Oppression also teaches us to turn our unexamined feelings inward, leading us in self-hatred or self-doubt or turning to fear. Being socialized as white can also be thought of as to become numbed, our body and spirit split, fragmented from relationships, habitually acting out of fear towards others, or accepting racism as a given in our society. And yet, in 2020 culture, in the state of our world, it's impossible to live in a body and not feel some sort of level of risk. We cannot be passively engaged and survive together in community. We cannot accept the benefits of white privilege as white people and never ask at what cost we receive such entitlements, because the answer is most surely a violence wrapped up with our own destruction as everyday people of faith. White privilege is a theological problem as much as it is historical, and embodied. Dr. Parker's story continues. The moment my friend in Pennsylvania and I left our car and felt the rain falling on our bodies, soaking our skin, and had to exert ourselves to scramble to safety was a blessed moment. Not because there is any virtue in danger, but because it was a moment when disoriented, alienated consciousness was interrupted. We became present to our environment. We ceased being passive observers or commentators. Our whole being, bodies, minds, and selves became involved with the requirements of the situation. We arrived. We entered in. We left our compartment and inhabited the world. No longer tourists passing through the country. We became part of the place along with everyone else that day, in that corner of Western Pennsylvania, in that storm. I speak of this experience, Dr. Parker writes, as a baptism because it was a conversion from distance to presence, from misconception to realization. It was an awakening to life, an advance into participation, and a birth into the world. This is the conversion that is needed for those of us who are white Americans. We need to move from a place of passive, misconstrued observation of our country into an active place of active, alert participation. In learning about racism and oppression as a Unitarian Universalist youth, I first found it overwhelming before I came to understand that I didn't have to have all the answers. In fact, as a white person, the most important thing I had to do was to listen and to love and to know that this love also has to redefine. To understand love not only as a feeling, but as an action, as bell hooks suggests. For if we love others as we love ourselves, we create justice. Thankfully, part of the education I received from my peers was the instruction not to make it the work of people of color I knew to teach me what I'd been socialized not to notice. That is, our work as white people is to support each other in the journey towards anti-racism and work for racial justice. So if you are white and feel the impulse to run to a friend or colleague of color after this service and say, tell me about what our country is like for you. Here's what I learned about what it was like for me. I beg you to resist that temptation, for that is not a beginning in relationship of mutual respect. We can become acquainted with our own country as white people, for instance, by immersing ourselves in the primary texts of indigenous writers in the myriad of publications by Asian American, African American, Latino, Latina, Latinx writers, and more across genre, across decade. And there is plenty to witness, plenty to listen to. And if we'll start to notice the way racism enters our lives, the subtle differences between fair and equal, this part of inhabiting our own country, our own bodies, is but by noticing what has been close by the whole time and not to claim it as our own. As Unitarian Universalists, I believe we can equip our own selves with knowledge and make it a spiritual practice to use it to resist racism and oppression. For those of us who have white privilege, we must renounce the privilege to not use that knowledge we have in service of collective liberation. I've been lucky to have white women trainers and mentors who were socialized in different decades than I was and how to undergo this conversion to humanity to understand my own privilege. A big part of my early journey towards activism was a weekly independent study sitting side by side with Claire Marie Hart, who was my English teacher, reading through her copy of the Norton Anthology of African American Literature each week. Sometimes I wonder what would have happened if I had walked in to ask my white English teacher to do this independent study with me and she had said no, or just referred me to an approved list for a reading list for high school seniors. How many nights must I have stayed up late only to fall asleep in the thin pages of the anthology. My earliest conversion from distance to presence was like so many other religious conversions, to see myself in threads of human experience and also not see myself, as it was not about me. I welcomed the joy along with the anger as both valid emotions in the fullness of what was moving inside of me. And it became so uncontainable that I needed to share it with others, with other teens in my hometown. We passed around James Baldwin's books, leaving notes to one another in the margins. My point is that emerging from the pit of privileged ignorance doesn't have to be lonely. There is a well-trodden path that you're invited on of race-conscious, engaged presence in the fullness of multiracial, multi-generational communities. And I invite you to notice the ways in which your body notices this, begins to warm or wake up, to thaw out, to the ways in which white supremacy has encoded itself. If you feel yourself becoming defensive or tuning out, I invite you to let that emotion move through you and out towards your fingertips. Perhaps you leave this service with unresolved feelings or contradictory feelings. I invite you to let those feelings be. If you have to hide or fix a part of yourself or a piece of yourself to arrive here, I hope you will offer generous comfort to that place. If you feel overwhelmed, may you be reassured that you do not need to take the whole world on at once. Together we can start as people of faith to name the injustices we see in our own community, participate in the social actions that embrace our consciousness and demand our response. As a whole community, we can counter violence by sustaining our witness through spiritual practice, renewing it for the long haul. My own coach, Vanisar Terakali, writes that the good news is that when we thaw out, we get our humanity back. When the pins and needles feeling of discomfort that might happen stops, we can use our foot again. Once we have processed and released any ancestral or personal racial shame we carry, we can access more energy, hope, and joy. From this loving place, we can make new choices to support racial and social justice. May we observe the ways in which we need each other. And through community, may we counter white privilege and racism and move towards those holy sparks within each of us, within this community, within the country we wish to inhabit. May it be so. Amen.